Proverbs 12:18. Some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise bring healing. Proverbs 15:1. A gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. Proverbs 15:28. The heart of the godly thinks carefully before speaking. The mouth of the wicked overflows with evil words. Proverbs 16:23-24. From a wise mind comes wise speech. The words of the wise are persuasive. Kind words are like honey, sweet to the soul and healthy for the body. Proverbs 17:9-10. Love prospers when a fault is forgiven, but dwelling on it separates close friends. A single rebuke does more for a person of understanding than 100 lashes on the back of a fool. Proverbs 18:13-14. If you repay good with evil, evil will never leave your house. Starting a quarrel is like opening a floodgate, so stop before a dispute breaks out. Proverbs 24:26. An honest answer is like a kiss of friendship. Proverbs 25:11-12. Timely advice is lovely, like golden apples in a silver basket. To one who listens, valid criticism is like a gold earring or other gold jewelry. Proverbs 27:5-6. An open rebuke is better than hidden love. Wounds from a sincere friend are better than many kisses from an enemy. This is God's word.
Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. I just want to name that it feels like kind of a dead room today, and I think I figured it out. I think I figured out what's different, and that is that my talkative buddy Roland isn't here. Normally, Roland is like, if he's not talking to me, he looks like he's about to, and it just changes things. So anyway, I miss you, Roland, if you're out there on YouTube or whatever. Look forward to having you back next week. Our topic today is hard conversations. And I wanted to open with kind of a confession that I don't like them. And I don't like them, not just because, you know, they're annoying or whatever, but I personally, in my own experience, have like a bodily response to a hard conversation, to certain types. And it makes it tough. I have this core memory where we had a guy working on some design projects for our home, and he wasn't finished, and I hadn't seen any of them yet. But he was asking me for money, like he needed more money to work on it. And I was saying, I don't feel comfortable giving you more when I haven't seen anything you've done. And he got very upset. And he actually kind of demanded, he's like, I'm not going to do any more of this for you. And we had paid him some, unless you give me money. And I was like, I really think you need to show or give me some product of what you've done in exchange. And it got heated. And we ended up coming up with a deal where we would, he was like, I am going to drive with you to the bank. And then when you give me money, I'll give you this, and you can then verify that it's done. And it just got really awkward and weird. And on the way to the bank, my legs were shaking, and I was like, whoa, wait a second. This is a strange experience. Like, what's this tension that's in me is like trying to get out of my body. And so I don't know how they affect you. I mean, some people I've noticed seem to love them. The harder the conversation, the better. Like, let's argue. For me, it actually it does something to me internally that makes it really hard to show up and stay present sometimes. And I just wanted to tell you that because I think when we think about hard conversations, it's not as simple as just should we or should we not have them. But like, how do I get through this? You know, based on how I'm responding internally to it. How funny, right, for me that I became a pastor when I have that struggle. I've thought about this several times. How interesting it is that God kind of said to me, this is going to be a role where you have to have such conversations, and I'm not going to let you out of it. Like, that's a role that you're going to get, and you're going to have to learn to walk with me in it. And I think that might be true for some of us, if not all of us, to some degree. Whichever version of it makes you uncomfortable, perhaps God's going to say to you, I'm not just going to bail you out, but I promise to be with you. One of the ways God has been with me is through other people. You've met Rod before, some of you, the big, tall guy who sits in the stool now with the beard and the deep voice that looks like Gandalf. And Rod loves to pester me about the conversations I should have at breakfast. I'll bring up something and he goes, wow, that sounds like you really know what you should say. Did you say that? And, you know, and often I go, well, not yet, or, you know, not that way, not the way I just said it to you. And he goes, oh, well, Andy, how's that going for you? You know, and I love that question. I hate that question. Cause he's always right. It's what he's saying is, it's going to have to happen at some point. If it needs to be said, it's going to have to come up at some point. You can't avoid this. So today, as we continue to study Proverbs during ordinary time in our series on wisdom literature, we're going to wrestle with the idea of having hard conversations. There's a few different ways to do it. The version I just talked to you about, my little story, was kind of just an interpersonal difficulty. We're going to hear from Blake a little bit later, and Blake is kind of an expert in helping think through how to talk about things like politics that are complicated or things like that. A lot of times religious conversations can be heavily charged because our beliefs are really getting challenged. But we know that we need wisdom. And as we study wisdom, we're going to ask, how does it bear out on hard conversations? And today, part of why I asked Blake to help me out is I feel like we've circled around this topic several times in the last month and a half. We've talked about some of the divisiveness, you know, Cruz talked about divisiveness, and we've talked about other themes. But today, I want us to get really practical and just ask, how could wisdom really, really guide us right in the middle of a hard conversation? To start off, though, we're going to go through three things: when we need hard conversations, how to have them, and the goal of them, the ultimate goal of them. But under the, you know, when we need them, why we need them, I just want to go through the ones that we listed today, thinking about these two ideas of being avoidant or combative, avoidant or combative. I want to suggest that both of those ideas, being avoidant, which is maybe, so for me, if I'm feeling that tension, like I talked about, or something internal, that can make you want to run away, flight, right? Like, get me out of here. I don't know how to control what's going on within me. I just need space. Avoidance can be a result of feeling that way. Combative is the other side, fight, right? Which kind of has a similar thing. It's like, I don't know what else to do other than to win and get you to go away. And both of those ways of approaching things, I think in effect say, go away. I will not speak to you, or I will speak to you so much that you give up. Combativeness or avoidance. And I think there's something to be said about finding a different way than combativeness or avoidance. Like I said, we're gonna get a little more practical, but I want us to look at the Proverbs that Ty just read to us for a second, and I want to ask for a gut response from every single one of you to every one of the Proverbs, and just a show of hands, and I'll exhibit how to do it on the first one. But have you ever taken one of those personality tests where you have to pick one or the other? Like, you don't get to give it a 5. You have to just say that is either that or that. That's what I want you to do with avoidant or combatant. Does this proverb feel avoidant, or does it feel like combat? Like, it's calling you into combat. And I know there's a middle space. So then after each one of them, after we say which one it feels like, I want to take one comment, if you have one, on why it's not quite that. Okay? Just So everybody's going to do the hand thing, and then I'm just going to take one comment. So here's how it's going to work. I'll give you an example. The first one, some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise bring healing. If I had to pick, I'd say that's more avoidant because it would be, it feels like cutting remarks would be more combat and, you know, healing words. That feels a little bit like trying to soften the situation, right? And then if I were to make a comment on that, I would say, but it doesn't say get out of the situation. It doesn't say disengage. It actually suggests engagement and speech into the issue, just in a specific way, a way that brings healing. So that's not combat. It's not avoidance. It's engagement thoughtfully, right? So that would maybe be a comment that I would give. Like, it, though it feels that way, it's not. Got it? Okay. Here's our next proverb. Gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare. Avoidant, combative. Oh, we're split. I like that. That's exciting. Hey, Rebecca, why did you, I'm going to specifically say, why did that feel more combative to you?
The word harsh is combative.
Oh, yeah. So you, the word harsh just stood out to you when you heard it. And it, oh, okay. Yeah, so it kind of presents two options, right? The gentle answer deflects anger, which is why I assume some of us thought avoidant, right? Like, but then the harsh word makes tempers flare, and it kind of just puts them next to each other and doesn't necessarily say pick one. It just tells you what's going to happen. Yeah, okay, good. We did it. Next. The heart of the godly thinks carefully before speaking. The mouth of the wicked overflows with evil words. Is that avoidant? More or less? Combative. Okay. We went much more avoidant, but I want to hear Courtney on why you said combative.
Well, I feel like the first part implies like there's a plan to confront it.
Uh-huh.
There's never the option that they're not going to, but they're thinking a little bit more before doing it, so that's why I think it's combative.
Yeah.
I feel like avoidance is happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Courtney's saying there seems to be a plan that you will confront in this text, even though, you're going to put a lot of thought into it. There still is, you're moving into it, right? Is that a good summary? Okay. Ish. Yeah. You said it so much better. Okay, great. Next one. From a wise mind comes wise speech. The words of the wise are persuasive. Kind words are like honey, sweet to the soul and healthy for the body. Avoidant, if you had to pick. Combative, we're leaning a little, we're a little split on that one. We're a little, okay, Ray, why did you say combative on that one?
Action-oriented.
Action-oriented? Yeah. Yeah. Are you sensing what I'm sensing already in the room? Like, we're already switching our thoughts on this and leaning kind of toward, like, if there's a plan, it feels more combative. Where like the first time we weren't thinking quite like that. Yeah. Love prospers when a fault is forgiven, but dwelling on it separates close friends. A single rebuke does more for a person of, that's on me, isn't it? Understanding than 100 lashes on the back of a fool. Avoidant? Combative. Yeah, we had like one or two for avoidant that time. Okay, I'll just open this up. I won't call on anybody. What do you think's going on in that? Or actually, no, I changed my mind. Scott, you were one of my avoidants. You're like, I knew it. What led you to say avoidant on that one?
I don't think it doesn't have an immediate call to action.
Yeah, didn't have an immediate call to action. Yeah, good. I like that. Let's see. Okay, this is the great one that was different in our slides than on my paper. So that's exciting. I had love prospers when faults are forgiven. This one, spouting off before listening to the facts is shameful and foolish. The human spirit can endure a sick body, but who could bear a crushed spirit? Honestly, this one's great. Even though it's not in my sermon, but I like it. Let's Yeah, let's roll with it. Spouting off before listening. Okay, avoidant or combative? Which one is it encouraging? Avoidant, avoidant, combative. Okay. All right, Daniel, what feels combative about that one?
It's like a quick.
Yeah.
When
you're
spouting off.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's addressing the quick response versus taking time to reflect and hear what's being said. Yeah. And it seems to imply, I think these two went together because the human spirit can endure a sick body, but who can bear a crushed spirit? The idea, I mean, have you ever been spouted off on to the point where your spirit just feels weak? It's not a great feeling. And that's sort of what this is saying. It would almost, it'd be better to be sick than to be yelled at, essentially. That's the next part of that. Or did I miss one? I missed one. An honest answer is like a kiss of friendship. This is an interesting one. Is that more avoidant? Yeah, we don't kiss our friends anymore, do we? Avoidant or combative? Yeah. Justin, why is that combative? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and this one, an honest answer is like what it starts with, right? Like, you're going to give the honest answer. And that feels so, I mean, I think, you know, the kiss of friendship implies like a dear friendship. And that doesn't feel right. Like, do you really always want the honest answer? I mean, it seems like it's trying to teach us to receive an honest answer that way, which is could be a challenge. Timely advice is lovely, like golden apples in a silver basket. I mean, I've never seen that, but I think it'd be nice. To one who listens, valid criticism is like a gold earring or other gold jewelry. I saw an interview with Mr. T yesterday. Remember Mr. T? And they were asking him why he wears all his gold jewelry. And he went on this awesome speech about why he wears the gold. He's like, I wear the gold. And he like gave all these reasons. Anyway, I pity the fool. But it's when you think gold earring, gold jewelry, especially back then, it was the mark of royalty. It was like, this is like wealth, honor, it was high praise to wear gold jewelry. So is this combative? I switched it. Combative or avoidant? Okay, we're getting shy on this one. Combative or avoidant? I don't know. Alex, why'd you say avoidant this time? Yeah. Yeah. So to give timely advice and listen seems more patient, and sometimes that could be taken as avoidant, right? Like it's not moving in as quickly as other approaches. Our final one, an open rebuke is better than hidden love. Wounds from a sincere friend are better than many kisses from an enemy. Combative, avoidant. Yeah, no avoidance today. Like open rebuke. And doesn't that sound like in your face? Wounding, like that's an interesting one. I recently had my manuscript for the memoir I'm working on. I gave it to a trusted person to destroy, you know? And there were like 6 comments per page, and there's a lot of pages, and that was a lot of comments to read, and a lot of that doesn't make any sense to me. You know, didn't you already say that? Just wounds, you know. Actually, I thought of this scripture when I got it back. It was like, he did a really good job critiquing my work, which means he tried to catch everything. And that is what I need. But it still felt like, oh man, he just saw and called out all my flaws, right? feels combative. So even just a brief contemplation of these Proverbs shows us, I think, even though I made you vote, there's some kind of really important space between. There's like, if combative is one side of the equation, avoidant is the other, there's this space between, which is where we want to live, where we do confront things and we do speak, but we don't say, go away and just get away from me, whether it's the fight or the flight. In Proverbs, we're encouraged to fear the Lord. Fearing the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So when we think about this idea of having hard conversations and not just making people go away, but really addressing things, it made me think of one of the greatest patriarchs in our faith, Moses. And Moses was called to lead an entire nation. And we know a little bit about Moses from the Bible. We know he didn't love to speak. He felt like that was a weakness of his. I can only imagine that he probably didn't, if he didn't like to speak, he probably didn't like confrontation, right? He probably didn't like the difficulties that were going to come with leading a whole nation of people. And there's this profound moment, and there's a lot to this, but Moses and God's people have been delivered from Egypt, and they are out in the wilderness. So God has taken them out of slavery. He's delivered them. There have been many mighty acts of God that have given them this freedom. And then God brings them to a mountain, and to them, this is very significant. Mountains are like where you could meet with God, and God is at the top of the mountain, and he's going to reveal to them who he is through his law. And his law, in a way, is, you know, him telling us, confronting us in a way. It's, here's what you should and shouldn't do. And Moses goes up and he gets the tablets of the law, and he comes down and he discovers that the people are already reverting to idolatry, like the ways of the Egyptians. They've made a golden calf for themselves. They're calling out to it. They're already straying from the God who's delivered them. And Moses is just so angry. Like, I almost imagine, was he shaking, you know? And he takes the tablets and he just smashes the tablets of the law. And it's just this terrible scene. It's like the new life of God's people after they're delivered from Egypt is just so not working. It's in such bad shape really, really quick. And then Moses, by God, is invited back up the mountain, and God's going to give the covenant tablets to him again. And the people want to see God. They want to know that this is really God they're talking to. And Moses goes up there carrying this desire of theirs to see God. And God, there's a lot to the story, but gives him new tablets, but also reveals himself to Moses, lets him see just the trail of his back, the back end of his garment. But he says something to Moses, and I think it's so important. Exodus 34, 5 to 10. So think about this in this moment. Moses has just gone down to the people he's supposed to lead. He just got really angry. It's all not going well. And now God's going to reveal something about his character. And this is what God says. This is what we read at first. The Lord came down in a cloud and stood with him, with Moses. And he called out his own name, which is Yahweh, which is, we know, means I am. It's like this pretty incredible statement of who God is. And the Lord passed in front of Moses, calling out, Yahweh the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy. I am slow to anger and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness. I lavish unfailing love on 1,000 generations. I forgive iniquity, rebellion, and sin. And if I right now were to say avoidant or combatant, that would sound avoidant, right? Love, compassion, I forgive, I look over sin. But I do not excuse the guilty. I lay the sins of the parents on the children and grandchildren. The entire family is affected, even children to the third or fourth generation. And all of a sudden, if I were to say avoidant or combatant, you would be like, combatant and really, really, really combatant? Like, that seems intense. So how did Moses respond? Moses immediately threw himself to the ground and worshiped. And he said, "O Lord, if it is true that I found favor with you, then please travel with us. Yes, this is a stubborn and rebellious people, but please forgive our iniquity and sins. Claim us as your special possession." And the Lord replied, "I am making a covenant with you in the presence of all of your people." And he goes on to give him the law and send him back down. See, Moses' response to this revelation of God is that, in a way, that combatant side of God, Moses says, "You're right. You're right to confront us. We are stubborn. We are rebellious. Like, it's true." But he also sees this side of God that is full of mercy, and he realizes, in the face of this God, what I should do is throw myself down and plead for him to have mercy, to be with us, to be our God. I want to know this God that can do both at the same time. So I believe that to fear the Lord, which is what we're taught to do in Proverbs, the beginning of wisdom, is to learn to be shaped by that God who is able to confront us with the truth, but also is so overwhelmingly merciful that it actually compels us to want to be in his presence, and that we should be shaped increasingly to reflect that God to our world. So I want to have Blake come up now at this point. And Blake's going to tell you a little bit about what he does and why he does it briefly. But I met Blake a while back at a pastor's group here in town before he ever came to mission. And it's been really fun to have Blake and Courtney here. It's been great to have you both. But Blake has put a lot of time and effort in his studies and now in his work into helping people move into difficult conversations, to teach them how, and as a Christian, also some of the why we do this. So I want Blake to come up and teach us all, and I look forward to that.
Hi, everybody, and hi, Roland, online. I just want to thank all of you, too, for welcoming Courtney and I into mission this summer. It's been a great season. It's great to get to learn with you. Andy says I'm an expert. I am not an expert in any of this. I just get lots of practice. And it's funny to me, too, because Courtney, my wife, who I learned from most, is sitting here with a journal to take notes on whatever I have to say. And so I hope you feel like I'm getting to learn with you, because hard conversations are not easy to learn from. They are not easy to have. The work that Andy is talking about is working with this organization called the One America Movement that works with ministers around the country and congregations to sort through a lot of the hard conversations that we have so much trouble having today. We are looking to identify, what do we do in that middle space between being avoidant of conversations that we want to have, that we need to have in our communities, between being really combative and driving people away. And that middle ground, that's the stuff of wisdom. That's what the wisdom literature is getting at. We are in that middle ground, and one of the ways we can move forward in that is through peacemaking, through resolving conflict in redemptive ways that speak to, like what Andy was saying, the God that we have faith in and are witnessing to. And one of the things that I feel like also sums up that work that I do, which I can talk a little bit about, is the proverb that we actually don't have on the slide deck. So I can read it. I think I can read it. No, I can't read it because I don't have a copy in my notes, but that's okay. So the proverb that I think Ty read was something along the lines of, there is this floodgate of evil that is done, and adding on to evil and evil and evil is something that in wisdom, we are called to steer as far clear from as we possibly can. And I think when I read that, at least in the notes, not in what we have here, it made me just think about a lot of conversations that we're having in public today. And that's where things really connect to the work that I do, meeting with pastors, meeting with ministers and congregations who are saying, my community doesn't know how to have a hard conversation in a healthy way because we're all experiencing that. We've given a lot of examples, too, and I'm sure you've thought of some examples of where this shows up in one-on-one relationships, but even in our entire community, there is a dumpster fire of conversations that we want to stay away from because we don't know how to have them. Things that we read on social media, things that we see in the news. These days, it's really easy to feel like those polarizing topics are no-go zones, even though having some conversations there would help us bring more healing to our communities or learn more along the way. And that's, of course, something we get to experience in our close relationships with family members, with coworkers. And there are dynamics at play there that we can talk about together that also make a lot of those people either close to us or far away from us feel like our enemies, which leaves us with the question in the trainings and workshops that I get to do with religious communities everywhere across the country, and even here in Tucson, is just how do we have hard conversations, not just with our friends, but also with our enemies? What are we to do about that? So I actually think we've talked a lot about hard conversations. We haven't described them. I want to invite you to participate and just sound out in a short activity here. I want you to think of a hard conversation that you have had, something that's come up for you, something that you felt in your body. Maybe even you just noticed there was a switch from where the conversation started to this moment that you had. Think of a hard conversation. What made that conversation hard for you? Even just a word? Or something about that you'd like to share? That is a great and a really brave answer. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, there's a heaviness to it, right? Of knowing some of the things we're talking about are even bigger than what we're talking about, right? And that worldview differences, different experiences, not knowing what's on the table or what you have the trust to talk about, to share. No, yeah, that is real. That heaviness is real. Thank you for sharing. Anybody else? What, when you think of this hard conversation that you might have experienced, what made it hard for you? Rebecca? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for sharing. No. We don't know where the other person is coming from sometimes, right? Yeah. And I can imagine too, follow-up question, bonus question here. There's an element in that of not knowing, am I going to be heard, right? Or understood? Am I going to be understood? Yeah, definitely. For those of you who thought of a conversation that was hard for you, did anybody think of a conversation where they felt unheard? Nodding your head. Can I call you out, Ty? What was that experience like of feeling unheard? The things that you really noticed in that moment? Not this person not noticing some of the wrestling you were doing in that moment too, between avoidance and combativeness, that approach that you were trying to take to find that way out and not feeling like you were recognized in that they were hearing you. Yeah, that they were following up maybe too and trying to explore that with you. Yeah. I really appreciate all of you answering. And I'd bet to say that these are all experiences we have on a daily basis. And some of these things too, they're really hard to sit with when we want to find that way out. Right? We want to bring healing to this. But also, these are things that are happening behind the scenes in our brains all the time that we don't know what to name. We don't know what it is. We just notice it and feel it when it's happening. And some of this is because this is cognitive and subconscious things happening here. These hard conversations that the three of you described, especially when you said you felt it in your body too, right? Either if you have been sharing with somebody and you noticed that, or you were on the receiving end and you had felt unheard and noticed something shift in your body or in your brain. One of the really interesting things about that we get to learn from social science in a lot of the research that we dig through, even in our work with churches, is that we start listening to somebody or talking to somebody with a different part of our brain than what we started. The part of the brain that you switch to when you're describing these experiences is the amygdala, the fight or flight part of your brain. And it happens so quickly without us noticing because we're actually doing an assessment every 5 seconds. It's really, really simple, even though we all know what it feels like. Is this person a friend or are they a foe? Is this person on my team or are they on another team? That's something that we're doing every 5 seconds. And if you've been in those situations that we had described or you thought of your own hard conversation, you might have noticed that there was a switch for you when you thought, I don't know if this person is on my team. I don't know if this person is hearing me or understanding me, right? And today, one of the reasons that the work that my nonprofit does and I get to focus on is talking about hard conversations, not just in a one-on-one way, but in a common way, in a public way, is because the types of hard conversations that we're exposed to put our amygdalas in overdrive all the time. When we're taking in information online, when we notice that there's a side conversation going on, maybe at a restaurant or out on the street, that sends you in a totally different train of thought than you wanted to think about, because we need a break from that. We experience that heaviness, that anxiety, that frustration all the time. And one of the examples that we use in our work is this example to describe this of an elephant and a rider on top of the elephant. And this is just a metaphor for some of this stuff that's going on. When we have these moments, the elephant represents our subconscious brain. And the person on top of the elephant is the rider. That's our conscious brain. That is this dynamic that we're faced with when we end up in these tough situations where if there's a mouse, which I don't even know if this is true. This would be something we should do more research on, maybe. Something scares the elephant. Who do you think is in charge? Elephant's in charge. Yeah. Say it again. The mouse is in charge. That's a little disempowering, so I'd push back on that. But the mouse isn't, it's not insignificant, right? A mouse to an elephant can steer that elephant in any direction other than where we want it to go. And in the situations you're describing, we only notice that it's happening when the elephant starts to take us in a direction we don't want to go. When our subconscious brain starts flagging things in our bodies or making us think things or put us on defense. And this is just, it's a really helpful metaphor for thinking about what happens when we're in hard conversations, how that feels to us, how that feels to other people too. When, like you said, you were trying to give sound advice, to share wisdom, and it was hard to anticipate, is that person ready to hear it? How are they going to deal with this? This is what happens in our relationships between groups too. Research shows that when we encounter information that's contrary to what maybe our group agrees on, or maybe something that we're really, really valuable of, that when we get that information, we automatically start associating different ideas and different things to that person before we've even gotten to follow up with more questions. And this is all, again, because our brain is trying to protect us. We are looking for threats every 5 seconds. And when we do that, it's actually not really about the other person. We're looking for things that make us feel safe. Things that will assure us and help us know I'm understood here. I can keep this relationship going. It can go deeper. It makes it really hard to know what we can do when hard conversations are everywhere, when we can't avoid them, and when we even freeze, or we fight, or we fly away, we're definitely at risk of hurting others or hurting ourselves if and when our brains get in the way here. And again, one of the things here that lets us really sit with this, especially with the three of you and what you were describing, is we want that way out, right? We don't want to leave things there. And if you are a Christian, this might especially pull on your heartstrings because we've actually seen a way we can be different. And I think something that Paul says in Romans 12 here is kind of this reminder that all of these people who met Jesus, seeing Jesus coming to relationship with Jesus and seeing his invitation for the world, really pushed them to try and figure some of these things out too. He said, live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people, and don't think you know it all. Never pay back evil with more evil. Do things in such a way that everyone can see you are honorable. Do all that you can to live in peace with everyone. I don't know if you feel this way. That feels like a high ask for us, for me. We get James saying, understand this, my dear brothers and sisters. You must all be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. Human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. These are people who met Jesus and really took the fear of the Lord to heart. They sought out wisdom from Jesus, from our Lord. They copied his ways. They followed in his footsteps. And when we go back and we revisit the Proverbs here, some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise bring healing. I don't think I missed anything there. Yeah. When we live by the fear of the Lord, it's not just about navigating our own safety anymore, right? It's also about going into hard conversations in the confrontational and healthy confrontational ways that you described that actually bring healing to the other person too and to our relationship with them, right? This might sound really idealistic because it's hard to imagine that we can get a lot of healing here and out there. And that's why we start small. When we're going to talk about some practical things we can do, these are things that might not actually go all the way through the resolution, right? These are things that we're going to do. We can practice. We can fail at through grace, through knowing that Jesus has showed us if we're going to try not to be avoidant, we're going to try not to be combative, and we're going to try and be a peacemaker, that he's also going to lead us into a place where we can bring healing in hard conversations in places that feel like the divide is impassable. And ultimately, we could say, and I really like, let's see, James's phrasing on this too, we could say too that the fear of the Lord totally transforms how we see anger, what that looks like for us, that it changes the way we listen and it changes the way we speak. So I want to give you some practices that, again, I'm not an expert in. I'm just practicing through the work that I get to do with Courtney and the work that she does in campus ministry and also working with ministers around the country. We're just going to sum these up with three things. So first, kind of make a movement in the fear of the Lord from being quick to anger to checking our assumptions. And I have an activity that, for me, requires one volunteer, and this needs to be a person who drives a vehicle. And if you want and you're comfortable, you can come up here, and there could be a prize, but if you just want to share out, raise your hand from your seat, I would gladly ask you some questions here. Not hard questions, just gut level reaction questions. Y'all have shared a lot today. My friend in the back. Only if you want to. You can stay back there if you'd like. Okay. I'll go ahead and borrow this mic over here to you. Thanks for coming up. So, let's say that you are driving around Tucson. It could have even been on Broadway over here to Mission Church tonight.
Okay.
And somebody cuts you off in traffic. What do you think of that person? What's your reaction?
Well, take his driver's license away.
Take his driver's license
away. He doesn't belong on the road. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my initial response.
The laughs are because we sometimes agree with you, for sure. That's absolutely true. And you can boo if this feels like a little too much. Let's say that you see that this driver's car has a California license plate on it.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Well, I grew up in Los Gatos, California.
Okay.
But that was in the days when California wasn't really wild. Mm-hmm. This was in the early 50s. A long time ago.
Not the California drivers.
No, California is totally. I mean, you could go to any state park on the day you wanted to go, and you could camp there. No reservations, no nothing. The whole state was like that. Absolutely. Now I hear it's 2-3 years in advance. You've got to know exactly when your vacation is going to be.
There are whispers. There are nods around the room. People are going to the National Parks website right now because you reminded them they need to book for 2 years from now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
It's happening. Okay. That's,
I just changed.
That's true.
California is a much different place.
Thanks for sharing. So my last question for you. Let's say you're out driving tomorrow and you cut somebody off in traffic. Does this happen to you?
I have done that.
Tell us about that moment.
Well, I'm extremely embarrassed because I realize what I did, and I kind of know what it feels like on the other side of the fence. So now I'm sorry, please, don't pull your gun out.
I mean,
some people that could happen.
No, it feels like there's a threat there, right?
Yes.
Can you remind me your name?
My name's Richard.
Richard, everybody thank Richard.
What? Can I give a little parable story? It's kind of related to some of this. So in this little story, this guy is reading his magazine, and he's got a little puppy dog. I mean, you know what little puppy dogs do. Well, he had just had some really nice slippers, and they were underneath the couch, and he was just really enjoying himself. Well, anyway, the puppy comes up, grabs one of those slippers, and starts chewing, and then the guy with the newspaper, I mean, and we're going to call it a magazine, he rolls that magazine up. What do you think he's planning on doing? And that puppy starts running. Well, man, he's really getting angry. When I get a hold of that puppy, he's going to know not to do that ever again. Don't ever do that to your kids. But the moral, the beauty of this story is that let's say that puppy, now you can think about our wonderful Heavenly Father. He doesn't come after us with a newspaper. But our responses have a lot to do with it. So let's say that little puppy starts to run, and this guy's chasing him, and he rolls over on his back. He puts his little paws up, sticks his little pink tongue out. What do you think that guy's going to do? Think he's going to beat him? No. He's going to grab that little puppy in his arms and say, "I love you." It's a good response to that's a response of wisdom. If you're ever in trouble, that's kind of a good response to do. It really. So what parable would that? What proverb would that remind you of? Okay. What proverb would that remind you of?
Which one does it remind you of?
Reminds me of a soft answer, turneth away wrath.
There you go.
So the puppy.
Richard, it's going to take some improv, but I'm going to try and connect to that a bit more. Thanks for sharing. For everyone who didn't know, the prize was getting to see Andy's clock. That's all I have. But no, so in these situations where we're reacting, we take in a little information, a California license plate. It's easy to make assumptions off of that, right? That's something we call motive misattribution. This is when we hear something, someone do something, say something counter to maybe where we're going, what we want, what we think is normal, and we automatically start assigning different motives to them. Well, and I say this because I've done this. I've lived in Arizona for a year and a half. I'm still doing this. I see somebody cut me off and think, I can't believe they did that. I cut somebody off. Courtney will tell you that I do this, And it really is just because I'm trying to get to where I need to go. It was not personal. I'm embarrassed too. This is another way that we get stuck towards confirmation bias. We start listening to somebody who says something that feels threatening to us. Somebody cutting us off in traffic. Someone behaving in a way that puts our sense of security, our safety at risk. We start looking for information that confirms that they're a threat. This is our elephant brain. This is what's happening. And the reason I bring this up is also to point us towards where Jesus points us. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says in Matthew 7, 1 through 5, "Do not judge others and you will not be judged, for you will be treated as you judge others. The standard you use in judging is the standard by which you will be judged. And why worry about a speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own? Hypocrite. First get rid of the log in your own eye, and then you will see well enough to deal with the speck in your friend's eye." So again, picture this. This is something that's happening all of the time that Jesus knew very well about us. We have a log that gets in our way, and we really, really want to start working on other people's specks. One of the things we can do in our hard conversations is just check the log. We can start checking our assumptions here. It's dealing with our own logs first, because we can't remove the speck in other people's lives until we deal with that. This is wisdom from Christ. Our judgment and our management of logs, too, this is something that's done under grace, right? It's okay if it takes time. It's okay if it's second nature and doesn't come instinctively. But this is one of these things that we can do in these hard conversations, is take that moment to pause before we jump in or start making assumptions. And the second thing that I would encourage you to do is, instead of being quick to speak, be quick to ask questions. There's a metaphor that I got from an author who's been super helpful to me in this department, Monica Guzman, who says questions, they're like a telescope. The more questions that you ask, the more lenses that you're adding to your telescope. And in these moments where we're in a tough conversation and we don't feel heard, or we're not sure where the other person is coming from, and we start to feel this sense of threat, we can start asking questions. If you only ask one question or you don't ask any questions, your telescope is going to be very short. You're not going to be able to see very far, right? The more questions we ask people, the further we're able to see into what do they think? Where are they coming from? Are they doing this because they're a threat to me? No. We have to take our elephant brain a little further in curiosity. And questions actually push people from that enemy side of our brain to our friend side of our brain, because we start trying to connect with them, right? If you think back to Proverbs, this is where some of that healing can take place, is in relationship. Romans 12 again reminds us that we actually should start from a place of assuming we don't know everything we need to know. Questions are a way that we can actually start to see into somebody's story. And Rebecca, or Ty, to what you're saying, to actually make somebody feel heard, right? They help us build trust. And a good metaphor that I also got from somebody in my work for trust is, it's kind of like a bank. You actually do have to keep depositing trust. And the hard conversations that we have require us to withdraw a lot of trust. And in order to keep things going, we need practices that help us redeposit that so we can continue the conversation. Good questions create good listening and a strategy for us to get past some of these places our brain sends us to. And lastly, got to catch up to my notes here. Instead of reacting, again, in all of the ways that are nature to us, and rushing through conversations, I'd encourage you actually to play the long game here. There are this concept that, again, my author friend, I guess, Monica Guzman, came up with, called the conversation dials. And these are things that make a really successful conversation that we don't always get to pay attention to. But I just want to give you permission to plan for these. Those conversation dials are time, embodiment, meaning, are you in person? Is this a remote conversation? Is this happening online? Attention. Are they listening to you when you're saying something difficult? Parity. Are they your boss? That can change things a lot. Is there a type of imbalance with them? Do you know that they're on the same page as you, that they're your friend? And containment. Is this a one-on-one conversation? Is this happening out in public? One of the reasons that you may have thought of social media conversations when you thought of hard conversations, and one of the reasons that social media conversations just don't go well, is because they don't cover any of these. We're not in person. We don't have the time. We're reacting. We're rushing through it. And more time in our conversations makes it a lot easier to go the distance and to make mistakes too. It helps us ask questions, good non-adversarial questions, not like, why do you think that? I need an answer right now, but I didn't know that about you. When did you start to care about this issue? When did you have an experience in your life that made you feel that way? How do you wish people had a conversation about A or B or C? And another tip here that I'm actually sharing from Courtney, who I didn't think was going to be here, or else I would have asked if she could have shared it, because she would have done so way faster and much better, is that you can recycle conversations when you create time for that too. A tactic that Courtney practices with people in churches she works with is, if you end up in a hard conversation and you're able to put things on pause, you can go to other people you trust that might have a different perspective and say, hey, so I was just talking to a friend the other day about this, and I didn't know how to react. What's your reaction to that? What questions should I ask? When we step away from trying to rush through hard conversations, it gives us the space to go back and build more trust. You can go back and say, I recognize this conversation was really hard for you, and we didn't get to finish it, but thank you for engaging with me in that. You can go back and say, hey, this thing that you said really stuck with me, and I've never heard that before. I'd like to ask you more about that. And when you mess up, because our elephant will still send us in a different direction, you can go back and say, I wanted to talk to you because when I had this conversation with you, it really didn't go the way I wanted it to. I wish I had actually reacted this way. Can I try that again? This is a posture of humility that we see Jesus model in the way that he engages with us. God coming down and being with us when we're not at our best. This is something we can do in hard conversations too, because we're witnessing to something that's a little deeper than just getting on the same page. We're trying to get to connection with people instead of just agreement, right? When you have hard truths to share, your goal is to love that person and to be with them. This is one way that we witness how Jesus has loved us and has come to be with us. And that leads me into one thing to share that I think will just segue nicely into what Andy has to wrap us up, which was something that I got to hear from one of the religious leaders I work with at work, who said, the discipline that winning demands and the discipline that witness demands are not the same disciplines. And that really stuck with me, because a lot of the hard conversations that we have out there in public, that we have with large groups of people, and sometimes, if I'm being honest, some of the conversations I have with my closest people are more about winning or getting to an end goal, being combative, trying to avoid something, instead of being able to witness to them who Jesus is in my life, who I think they are to God, as somebody made in the image of God. All of these little tricks that we have and all of the things we're talking about by exploring the wisdom literature are just ways that we can start to witness more fully to who Jesus is and what a wise life under a wise king looks like. And I'm just going to leave it to Andy from here to wrap us up.
Thank you, Blake. Appreciate you, Blake. And Richard, you know what? That little puppy illustration is going to be stuck in my head. I have a feeling. That was good. Yeah, just to wrap this up, essentially, I just want you to think as we end here and kind of land back on Jesus, because as we've said throughout our whole series, it's not just that God gave us tidbits of information, wisdom in the Bible. He also has given us himself in Jesus, the wisdom of God among us, living in our midst. And I want you to think about the life of Jesus as a bit of a hard conversation, because here we are on earth. We are rebellious. We have our idolatries. We don't always pay attention to God as we should. We do tend to break God's law, and people are in conflict all the time. And God, being aware of this, sends his son into the world to encounter us, for us to encounter him. And of course, since the character of God is merciful and gracious, but will by no means clear the guilty, Jesus is coming into the world carrying that. He's carrying the mercy, the grace of God, but also the justice of God. And he wasn't silent when he comes into the world. He comes and he teaches, he proclaims the kingdom of God. In many ways, that's confrontational to the kingdoms of this world, to the some of the beliefs that we hold. But he also was, by very nature, full of mercy. And so he's gathering people that were far off, that were considered, you know, kind of like outsiders and unacceptable people. He's gathering them together with his other disciples. We know when we read the story of Jesus that it wasn't always an easy conversation to have. Not just with the crowds. Sometimes the crowds loved his teaching, but the other times they abandoned him. Not just with the religious leaders. A few religious leaders appreciated him and listened to him, but generally they kind of viewed him as a threat. But even with his disciples, who in many ways struggled with what he had to say to them, and sometimes found that Jesus was calling them into things they didn't want to do, places they didn't want to go, even though they felt like he was very wise and, like Peter said, had the words of life. So they felt compelled, but also challenged. So here's Jesus. He's not avoiding. He's entering in to our story, into our world, into our lives. But he also doesn't just come here to bring combat, to bring the hard hand of justice. When you think about his cross, as we start to lead into the Lord's table, I mean, he stays present even when people are entering into combat against him, when people don't understand why he's here, what he's doing, what his mission is, when people aren't listening. He stays present. He carries his cross. He endures. He even looks down on those who actually were his enemies, the Romans who carried out his crucifixion, the Jewish leaders who instigated it, the citizens who stood by and let it all happen, the disciples who generally ran away. And he shows us the fear of the Lord, and that he starts with mercy, and he says, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." And then as he dies on the cross, he is actually bearing the sin of generations of fathers upon their children, as he descends into death. So when the disciples look back and remember Jesus, and they remember that Last Supper where he talked about a new covenant in his blood for the forgiveness of many, they realize that the person who understood him the most was a Roman soldier at the foot of the cross who said, "Surely this was the Son of God." And that he was the one that wrote the terms of the covenant between God and his people, but he also bore the curse of them in order to redeem us, to take enemies. You know, while we were yet enemies, the Bible says, Christ died for us. And if that's how we are drawn near to Jesus, how much more should we learn to exhibit that to other people, to show up in chaotic spaces and have the kind of conversations that lead people to see who God is and to encourage them to be at peace with God in Christ. So just to land it, I would say the goal of conversations, if this is all true about Jesus, and Blake was speaking of how we follow Jesus, and I'm saying in a way, we is how we experience Jesus. then the goal of going into these hard conversations isn't just their success, because you can't guarantee that. You're just one party. You can't guarantee it. But they become a pathway of following Jesus, of knowing Jesus, of becoming formed in the image of Jesus and bringing the ministry of Jesus to others by actually bringing a taste of his kingdom every time we practice these things. And we do this out of a hope that we have that one day he will restore all things and that actually broken relationships will be healed and ultimately all of our failures along the way and the failures of the people who failed us can be wiped away if we simply look to him and what he's done for us. So as we move into our three final rhythms of worship, which are confess, receive, and offer, I want us to think about these things. Confession is a two-minute silence that we take here at Mission to come before God and kind of admit the truth. And today, as we think about hard conversations, what if you just thought about, you know, your tendency to avoid or be combatant, and ask God to help you see, if you don't, why it is that you're afraid of going there. And just admit that to God. I mean, God knows. But just come before God in your brokenness and say, look, this is what's going on in me. This is what I'm afraid of. This is who I am. And let God see you in that. See God while you're feeling that. Receive. When we receive, we come empty-handed to Jesus, and I'm kind of, as I'm framing it, this Lord's table where Jesus says, this is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of it, remember me. And this is my blood shed for the forgiveness of many. Every time you drink of it, remember me. Like his whole life and his death is something of a hard conversation with us. He's entering into the absolute difficulty of facing our response to him. And he's showing up in love and mercy and grace while also not neglecting justice and telling us the truth. Come and receive that from him and think about the powerful way he brings all those things together. And then as we walk away from the table into our idea of offering, this table is in the back here, and it's got our monetary giving, which is extremely important. But also, I want you to think today about one change you could make when you approach a hard conversation. And if you could boil it down to a word, one change I could make when it comes to approaching hard conversations, think about writing that word back there on the glass. And don't worry about getting it in between other words. We're trying to make a beautiful mess on that glass. But just memorialize that one thing you could work on and change. So I'm going to pray for us briefly and leave 2 minutes of silence for you to pray and confess. And then when Mike begins to lead us in music, I'll come up here and serve the Lord's Supper, and we'll receive. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the chance to gather together as God's people today and to hear, to think about your wisdom in the Proverbs, to think about the New Testament wisdom as well of what you've done and what you've called us to do, and ultimately to think about how you showed up in this world and approached us. And we pray that as we come before you and examine ourselves, why is it that we avoid or go into combat mode? Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. But most of all, give us the comfort of knowing that you are with us. You're on our team. And you're helping us, most of all by your grace, but also by walking with us each and every day by your Spirit. So guide us now as we pray.